Everybody, I'm Scott Horton. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. My website is weekendinterviewshow.com. I keep all the archives for you there in MP3 format. And also, I'm an assistant editor for antiwar.com. I write for them occasionally, and you might find me on the blog up there. Quick plug for libertystickers.com. I made up all the stickers, and I sold the company to Rick. So buy a bunch of stickers from him and tell him that I sent you, so he'll give me some more money. Also, quick plug to Derek's Martial Arts Gym, which I've been incorrectly saying the web address for the past couple of weeks. It's dmag.us, not .com, dmag.us for Derek's Martial Arts Gym, teaching Muay Thai and Kali in South Austin, Texas, where it is a beautiful day today. And I've got a pretty good show for you lined up today. In the first hour, I'll be talking with my buddy Paul Johnson from North Carolina about his gun case. And then in the second hour, I'll probably just be ranting and raving a bit on my own, although in the second hour we're going to start with a very special guest with news about upcoming brand new show debuting on the Republic Broadcasting Network tonight by someone who's been a regular guest of mine. I'm sure you all will be very happy to find out who's got the new show on Republic, so stay tuned for the top of the next hour to find out all about that. But real quick, we got to talk about guns. Well, real quick, as an intro to Paul, I don't like guns. But the thing is, I recognize that I don't have the right to keep the guns out of the hands of anybody else. Because after all, if somebody's trying to kill you with a gun, what are you going to do? You got to shoot them with a gun first. And, you know, a gun controller would say, well, no, you just got to keep that other guy from having a gun first. Well, who's going to take his gun? Guys with guns. Right. So gun control is a really stupid idea. And the fact is that human beings, whether they live in America or anywhere else, have a natural right to defend their life from someone who's trying to take it from them. And a tool is a very effective, a gun is a very effective tool for people protecting their lives. And of course, guns are great. Now, I have to agree with the One World commie types who push for global disarmament, want global gun control. In a way, I sympathize. And I got my own global gun control scheme. Here's how we do it. First, we abolish the United Nations. Then, we abolish any regional organization like NATO or anything like that, any kind of military cooperation between sovereign governments. Then we dissolve the nation states of the world. We have to disarm them, the nuclear weapons and all the aircraft carriers, submarines and fighter jets. Got to destroy all that stuff. Then we can disarm our state governments from their armories, their National Guard units, their police forces. Then when we get down to local county sheriff level, I think we ought to seriously debate whether perhaps we ought to just have private security and make them compete in a free market rather than letting any particular local county sheriff's department have a monopoly on police power. And then once the state has been completely dissolved and everyone trades freely and owns property and we all rub butts in fields of flowers and get along, then we can all just lay down our guns because we feel like it and we don't need them anymore. Doesn't that sound like a good way to disarm the world? That's what I think. And I don't know what you guys think about that, but I know for sure that you would prefer that to starting at the bottom and disarming the people and then the states and then the nations so that only the world government has a monopoly on war power. I don't think anybody wants that. Anyway, so that's my funny little libertarian introduction to a discussion about gun rights in this country. And my guest is Paul Johnson. He runs Radio War, Wilmington Open Air Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, 1610 AM, where he actually broadcasts this show every week. And Paul's got himself a gun case. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi there, Scott.
All right, well, hang on, because I talked all the way up until the music started playing. So stay there, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk about your gun case. How's that?
Great.
All right, cool. Everybody, hang on. It's the Weekend Interview Show. everybody. It's the Weekend Interview Show. Welcome back. Talking with Paul Johnson. He runs War Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, 1610 a.m. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Scott.
It's nice good to have you here.
Nice to be here, and thanks to you and to Republic for having me on.
Yeah, well, you're very welcome. So I guess you heard my little rant and rave there. I'm not too much into guns. I'm not really anti, you know, if a friend has a gun and invites me to go shooting at the range or something, that's fun, you know, go put a bullet on the target and all that. I'm into that, but, you know, it's just not really my thing to be into guns, and yet I respect freedom and the right of everybody to defend their own life however they see fit, as long as they're not taking out innocent civilians on the way.
Yeah, I think that's the way most Americans probably felt, you know, a good 50, 100 years ago. That's very close to the way the Quakers felt about it during the argument over the Constitution. The argument was never about whether we should outlaw guns or not. Those people were pacifists, and they fully understood why the Second Amendment was there. But, you know, the thing is that to characterize this case as a gun case is kind of is misleading, because I'm not standing on the Second Amendment here with this case. I'm standing on something rather different, because I'm not really a gun enthusiast either. I'm actually closer to you than I am the crowd that collects guns and goes to the shooting range every weekend and that sort of thing.
Okay, well, so if you're not standing on the Second Amendment, I guess we need to really get to the heart of exactly what happened here and what law you are trying to stand on in order to get your rights back.
Right.
So just start us off, basically. How'd you get arrested in the first place and when?
Well, the story really starts back in 1983, and I think people are familiar with in most states, I think in all states, and also there's a federal version of what they call the Felony Firearms Act, where people had decided that the legislature should outlaw guns for certain people, namely felons, which I can understand the sentiment there. There are people that are violent people that commit felonies, and you really don't want them to be a threat to society, and so you limit their rights. And I think most people, except for the most extreme among us, certainly if you send a murderer to prison, you don't send him to prison with a gun. If you are going to let him out, it may make sense to limit their rights. It is even within the power of government, whether we like that or not, right or for wrong, it is certainly within the legal power of government.
Okay, so what's your problem?
To do this. The problem is that at the time that I was arrested, the state of the law at that time was that this was 1983, and I pled guilty to a cocaine conviction, which, by the way, for those listening, that I hate cocaine now. I think it's one of the stupidest things that you can put in your body, and I don't do it, and I don't like hanging around with people that do it. However, I took my lumps. I pled guilty, and the state of the law at that time was that upon release from either prison or probation, which in my case that's what I had, was probation, upon release you got all of your rights back in North Carolina, with the exception of firearms. You could vote, you could do all the things that other citizens can do. However, it took 5 more years for you to get your gun rights back. And of
course, so Paul, when were you done with your sentence?
Done with the sentence in 85. By 1990, my rights were fully restored in North Carolina.
Okay.
With respect to firearms and everything else.
Okay, so everything was good up until 1990. Then what happened?
Right. Then it's simply a political complaint at that point. You know, how long should people, you know, whatever. But in 1995, the state legislature repealed the 5-year period. In other words, they got rid of the 5-year period, and your rights were restored immediately. Well, they didn't realize what they'd done at that point. they repealed the five-year provision. Well, basically, it gave everybody the right as soon as they were released. Well, they went back and fixed that. And then in 1995, they made another change. They basically changed it so that anybody that was convicted of a felony may never possess a gun.
Well, wait. Anyone convicted of a felony from that point on, right?
That is what was assumed. And, you know, the way government works, they usually enable power a long time before they start exercising it. And that's essentially what they did. It was not until, I believe, 1997 that anybody had dealt with this problem, somebody that was previously freed having their rights taken away retroactively. And there's where the problem is for a lot of people, that even people who believe in gun control, that don't think felons should. The problem here is not the Second Amendment. The problem here is, if you want to get constitutional about it, Article 1, Section 9, which prohibits what's called ex post facto laws, which is a fancy way of saying you can't change the rules in the middle of the game. So you can't make something criminal that was innocent when done. You can't increase the penalty retroactively. Now, there are certain laws that can be retrospective. However, the criteria is that if you have a vested right, it cannot be retroactively taken.
Right. So basically, these people, basically what's happened here, if I can try to sum up, you got busted on a cocaine possession charge, not for a violent crime, but for a possession charge in 1983.
Right.
You were finished with your sentence in 1985. Under the law at the time, you had all your rights back except your right to bear arms, which you had to wait 5 more years for. So in 1990, you were not only completely done with your sentence, but you had all of your rights completely restored to you. And then 5 years later, in 1995, the state government of North Carolina decided that if you have ever been convicted of a felony in North Carolina, from now on or even before, you are no longer allowed to bear arms. Is that right?
It's now permanent, and it's retroactive. It's on the face of the statute, that is what it says.
Okay, so how did it come about then that they knew you had a gun and took it from you?
Well, I got pulled for traffic violation. And they were trying to conduct a search that I objected to, and they searched me anyway, and I was on my way into the house. And in North Carolina, it is quite legal, even without a permit, to carry concealed from your car to your house. You're allowed to do that. I was parking at my house when I was pulled. So essentially, they had pulled me for that, and that, for a traffic violation. And then they, you know, things got to where they were searching. They find this gun, and oh my God, we're going to apply this law. They also charged me with resisting arrest, and they charged me with carrying a concealed weapon, which was not the gun. It was a pocket knife.
So they didn't charge you with carrying a concealed weapon for having a gun that you weren't supposed to have for being a felon, but they charged you with a concealed weapon for having a pocket knife?
That's correct.
Did they have to explain to the judge why they didn't charge you with carrying a concealed weapon for the gun, but only for the knife?
No, that was not an issue because they didn't charge me with it. The court doesn't answer questions that it is not asked. So that was never part of the proceedings. So I did 2 things that you're told never to do. One is I represented myself.
You have a fool for a client.
Well, how can you have a fool for a client when you don't have a client? And how can you have a fool for an attorney when you don't have an attorney?
Well, if you know what you're doing, do you know what you're doing?
Well, therein is the problem. I know a lot more now than I did then. I knew a lot more then than most people would, because I had been studying law for quite some time. Up until then, I had done some civil law, and so I was familiar with the rules of procedure and the rules of evidence and all of that fun stuff. I would not recommend it that anybody, I'm not going to tell anybody what to do to start with, but I would caution somebody that if you if you have not educated yourself up until you've got a problem, then it's not a very good time to start trying to educate yourself after the problem happens.
Well, what was the second thing that you did that you wouldn't advise besides representing yourself?
I took the witness stand.
Oh, you took the witness stand, so in basically opening yourself up to cross-examination, right?
Exactly.
And how did you fare under the cross-examination?
Well, it was a jury trial, and the main thing was that I was not trying to beat the charge, because you can't appeal something that you've won.
You're really trying to get the law overturned itself.
Hang on
right there, Paul. We've got to take this break, everybody. It's a weekend interview show on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Stay tuned. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Paul Johnson. He runs Radio War in Wilmington, North Carolina, WOAR, 1610 AM, an affiliate of this show. And we're talking about his case. So they tried to take away his right to bear arms retroactively for a felony conviction, nonviolent felony conviction from the early 80s. They've gone back and tried to take his rights away, and he's representing himself in court and fighting them tooth and nail for his rights back. So, Paul, take it from there.
Right. Well, you were talking about what happens when you go into trial, and I'll briefly describe that. But what's really more important in a case where you're talking about constitutionality is that there's a very important step that has to happen before you ever meet the jury, and that is, if you're going to argue the law, you have to do that first, before you start discussing the facts, because the jury is not there to sit in judgment of the law. They're there to sit in judgment of the facts. I know there's a lot of people that think that's wrong. However, I don't write the rules. And so if I'm going to prevail, I have to play by the rules, or otherwise I just get to complain about how it's unfair. And we'll get to what I argued before we got to the jury. After I tell you what happened with the jury, essentially what they did was the jury acquitted me of all this other stuff. The traffic violation was taken away. The resisting arrest charge was taken away. The jury said, no, he didn't do that. He didn't resist arrest. He objected to a search. As soon as he was under arrest, he quit impeding the officer. Then the carrying concealed weapon, I simply showed the jury the knife, and they went, well, this is a pocket knife, and the law exempts a pocket knife, so there went that. That left possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Well, I got on the witness stand and told him I had a gun. So at this point of things after the trial, none of the facts are in contention.
Right. You were basically hoping to go ahead and get convicted for being a felon in possession of a firearm.
Well, I don't know if I could go as far as to say I was hoping I was convicted. What I was really hoping was that my pretrial motion to dismiss was granted, because that's the way the law should work. In times where you don't have tyranny, knowledge of the law doesn't really come into play that often, because the government doesn't screw with you. In times where you have more and more tyranny, it becomes more and more important to know these things.
Right. The state themselves are the ultimate technicalitarians, aren't they?
That's exactly true. And so what I essentially did with the jury was they took away everything that is in contention except for, yes, I had a gun. Yeah, I had a felony conviction in 1983. So what? My rights were restored, and now the state's taking them away at a stroke of a pen. And that's what I'm challenging. Now, of course, to do that, you have to speak the language that is spoken in court, and you have to follow the rules, which is the really tough part for somebody to learn. You don't learn that sort of thing that quickly. And I almost did the whole thing where you get a lawyer and did all that. And what I did was I started watching cases while I was awaiting my time before the nice man in the black dress, and started watching attorneys work. And what I saw was that, you know, I think I have just enough knowledge to do this, and I think I have just the right temperament to be able to do this. And I made a very difficult decision to handle it myself, which is what I did. So before the trial, I made a motion to dismiss on several claims. The first was ex post facto, which is Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Anytime you start talking about the Constitution, you need to be talking to a judge, and you need to be asking the court the right question. And you need to explain to the judge what we're dealing with is what's called superior law. The statute clearly prohibits this. However, there is a law that is superior to this, and it is written here, and it nullifies this law. That's what a constitutional argument is. If you start talking in that particular proceeding about the facts of the case, the judge will shut you down, because we're not there to talk about the facts. We're there to talk about the law.
Well, if you had your argument straight in the pretrial hearing, how come he didn't grant your motion to dismiss in the first place?
Well, he took 3 months to decide that.
He took 3 months to decide not to dismiss.
So you're convicted
on that charge, and now it's at the appeals court level then?
It went to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. The North Carolina Court of Appeals has sustained what the denial. In other words, they say, no, Paul, you're wrong. You're wrong. They can do this.
So now, are you taking it to the Supreme Court of North Carolina then?
Well, I've taken it to the Supreme Court of North Carolina, and that's where it is now. And they have issued a slip opinion saying they're denying it. So now it's up the federal chain, it looks like.
All right, everybody. We're talking with Paul Johnson from Radio WOAR in Wilmington, North Carolina. We'll be right back. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, talking with Paul Johnson from WOAR Wilmington Open Air Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina. And I'm looking at the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 3. No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. Now, what does that have to do with your case, Paul?
Well, that comes up twice in the Constitution. Also comes up in Article 10. One says it shall not happen in the United States. The other prohibits the states from doing this. Let's get into what it... Now we're getting the fun part, because all the who shot John about what happened is over with. None of the facts are in contention, and everybody agrees that I had a felony in 83. Everybody agrees the rights were restored. Everybody agrees that the legislature is trying to take them back retroactively. And so now the question is, can they do that? And if so, why? If not, why not? So what is ex post facto? We've touched on that a little earlier. Ex post facto is Latin for after the fact, roughly. And what people normally realize is that it is patently unfair to declare what you did yesterday to have a penalty today. I think most people understand the unfairness of that. And while that is true in this, it's maybe not the strongest legal argument. It certainly is the strongest common sense argument, is that you can't write a law or change a law that gives you a penalty like a loss of a right retroactively. And I think most people understand that. And that's one of the reasons why in my hometown, even some of the really left-wing anti-gun people are very uncomfortable with this, because what if it isn't a gun? What if it's the right to vote? could you decide that, oh, all these people that can vote today, now we're going to write a law saying because you did this in the past, you can't vote. Well, people understand the unfairness of that, and they understand that if you allow that precedent, and I cannot find a single example in the history of this nation where a right has existed and then has been repealed simply through legislative action based on prior behavior. I cannot find a place where somebody's right has been restored and then taken away without them doing anything. And that's what brings us to Bill of Attainder. A Bill of Attainder in old English law was where the legislature would pass a law basically that it was illegal to be Scott Horton.
Or, I think they have one of those.
Or a group of people. It is illegal to be black or something, right? There was also, and in fact, a Bill of Attainder was normally like, go get this guy and kill him. In fact, originally it was like what they were doing is placing this person outside the protection of the law. Rather than being a death sentence, what it really was permission to murder this individual.
Sort of like a letter mark in reprisal in the war power.
Right, except within your own country.
Right.
And what is a milder version of that and has also been ruled to be covered by that is what's called a bill of pain and penalties, so that rather than allowing death, you allow some other restriction of rights or denial of rights for some segment of people. And that certainly happened with the Jim Crow laws, touched on all this stuff. And so what has occurred in my case is that I had a right that was taken legally because of my behavior. Whether you think it's smart to do that or not is a political question, not a legal one. But it was quite legally taken from me, and then it was quite legally restored. All of that was through adjudication. In other words, there was a court that decided this. When the law was changed to basically repeal my right, it was done with no court action whatsoever.
And as you said, it was even pretty vague. It wasn't even necessarily that clear in the law that that's what they intended to do, right?
Well, there was certainly a lot of attorneys that, you know, that work for the state and the feds that were wondering about this and how it would be dealt with, because at one point the BATF, our lovely Federal Alcohol Bureau and Firearms people, had asked the state attorney general, Mike Easley, who is now our governor. They asked his office, what about this? Can we prosecute these guys now that your law has changed? Can we go back and get these guys? And they wrote an opinion to the BATF and said, yeah, go ahead and do it.
Well, and isn't that an interesting little wrinkle, too, that they have the federals coming in to enforce their state law like that?
And there have been some people that have had that problem. Now, I have a friend of mine that not long ago did have a federal problem with this. He was caught with a shotgun in his own house. And I'm not sure the particulars of that. In fact, he has not even gone to trial yet. But the feds came and got him. The state cut him loose. The feds got him. His name's Kent Chatfield. The feds got him and then released him. They dropped the charges. They said, we're not going to fight this. This is all up in the air with this Johnson case.
Right.
So, because
you got him on the run, man.
The process is not true. The problem here is that I really want to caution people. I don't want to discourage anybody for standing up for their rights however they want to do it. I do want to caution people that if they decide to go and play with the big boys in the big sandbox, you should have it together. You need to be comfortable objectively discussing things that make you emotional. You never make the mistake of arguing the law to the jury. You will be found in contempt of court very quickly for doing that, because that's not how the rules work. If you don't follow the rules, you will have a problem. Now, I did have who I consider to be a very good judge in the trial itself. At the conclusion of the trial, the jury had found me guilty, but the judge has stayed the order. In other words, my order in that case does not go into effect until appellate review is exhausted. And it looks as if it's going to end up in federal court here. The
state Supreme Court has declined to hear the case, you said, right?
Right. Now, of course, they have not said why, and they have not closed the case out yet. They could at any time come back and change their mind, although that is not very likely. Now, the question is, why did they refuse to hear it? And they usually don't tell you the answer to that riddle. I can tell you this. A lot of times, people go into court with where they are actually right, and the problem is, I think there was one case where a town had written a legislation that denied firearms ownership to private citizens. This guy filed a lawsuit.
Hey, they just passed one of those in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago.
Well, this guy filed a lawsuit saying that it was unconstitutional. And in fact, I agree, it probably is unconstitutional. He fought it up through the appellate courts, and they denied him. And, the thing is, they didn't write any kind of reasoned opinion on it. I think he fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court. Here's the problem. The guy wasn't damaged. The court will not hear an argument. Now, he didn't have a gun. He didn't get arrested. He hadn't been damaged. The court is not going to pass. This is from Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority. And sets up a bunch of stuff that the courts refuse to answer a question if this, that, and the other. And one of them is, party has not been damaged, there's no reason to answer the question. But if a guy really wanted to do something about it, what he needed to do was carry a gun openly, get arrested for it. Now
he's
been damaged.
Yeah, but you could get yourself shot that way.
That's
not fair.
Well, it's not fair, but then again... If it was fair, we wouldn't be needing to go to court.
Yeah, if it was fair, they wouldn't take the money for it right out of our paycheck without asking.
The court doesn't exist to create fairness. The court exists to right wrongs, so to speak, to answer questions when it comes to constitutional law, or in cases of did this crime occur, and if so, who did it? But see, with what my argument is not that. Is not that I didn't have the gun, not whether the law is stupid, not whether it's a good idea. The question is, does this constitutional provision override this statute? So essentially what happens is, a lot of times you'll have a case that I think most people, that once they understand what has occurred in my case, they understand that it's not fair. What they don't understand is how to explain that to the nice man in the black dress.
This is what you told me before about when you're representing yourself, you don't want to think like a lawyer, you want to think like the judge. What's it going to take to convince him?
That's true, because the other thing is that when you start dealing with people, I mean, you're not up against people that don't know what they're doing and are stupid and can't read. These attorneys are very good, and I spent maybe two-thirds of my research time arguing the other side. When I come up with an argument, I would then spend twice as much time shooting it down so that I can then rewrite it. And courts do make wrong decisions. If they didn't, you wouldn't have Supreme Court decisions. Rosa Parks fully admitted that she was sitting in that seat in the bus. And she lost every step of the way until she got to the Supreme Court. Every court was wrong, but she had preserved the argument. And that's what's very important, is that you make the argument timely and that you preserve that argument at every turn and that you don't stop making the argument and that you overcome the counterargument, because these people aren't stupid.
Well, you know, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, has a long tradition of finding excuses to not hear, or not even necessarily finding excuses, but just refusing to hear gun rights cases, whether they're Second Amendment cases or Tenth Amendment cases,
right,
or like you're saying, Article 1, Section 9 cases. They just do everything they can in the world to avoid the question of gun ownership because they don't want to have to admit that the Second Amendment says what it says, that all their federal firearms laws are illegal and unconstitutional, every one of them. So they just don't even want to touch it at all.
Well, there is a certain, there is a good argument for the other side of that, and that is that the Supreme Court is the highest court in the land, and it shouldn't be hearing everything. It should practice restraint. It should not be passing upon certain things. On the other hand, we do, you know, judges are political animals just like everyone else, and they're motivated just like everyone else. And what ends up happening is when you end up with a sticky wicket like this case and like a lot of other ones, you find yourself in the situation of having to not only claim that one and one is two, but explain why. And explain why in every possible imaginable situation. And you end up having to not just make your argument, but to counter the arguments that are made against your argument. And it is very easy to lose sight of the law when you get into a courtroom, particularly at the local level. And it's very hard to keep your emotions out of your argument. A lot of people that go into court by themselves have decided that they're right about something, and they may be right about something, but if they go in and they don't know how to play the game, they're going to have a devilishly hard time, particularly if the judge is trying to protect the status quo. And I can even understand why a judge would want to protect the status quo. After all, judges are loath to change the law. There's a lot of pressure right now, particularly from Republicans talking about activist judges. I would say this. I think that one of the things that I've found is that the press is a really bad element in all of this because they really don't understand what they're reporting. I've often found a case in the news, and then I go and look at what the judge said, what was actually written in the order, and what both sides had argued. And what I'm seeing is not so much that judges are being activists. What I'm seeing is that two parties come into court, the state and somebody else, or two parties come into court, and they make the wrong arguments. They ask the court the wrong question. And so you shouldn't really be surprised that the judge gives the right answer to the wrong question every single time.
Yeah, garbage in, garbage out.
What I'm seeing is that when you go to your local courthouse, you got two lawyers that are both just absolutely, both sides are making an argument that smells like the stuff that you find where well-fed bulls congregate since we're on the radio.
Yeah, careful now.
And I'm surprised at the amount of sense that can be made by the judge out of these arguments, because a lot of times both sides have got it wrong.
Well, if you're a judge and you know that both sides are making stupid arguments, but you know what the right one is that not within your discretion to say, no, guys, this is what the law says, and this is the way I'm deciding?
Well, the short answer is no. He is certainly free to make a take judicial notice of something that he had that is true. However, he is not to be an advocate for either side. He's not going to correct the prosecutor and say, now, Mr. Prosecutor, don't you think you should object to his question?
Yeah, but isn't he supposed to at least do that for the defense, if not for the state?
Well, you know, we decided we didn't want a court system like that. We at one time in this country had a legal system. We now have an adversarial system. We decided that we didn't want the judge to be an inquisitor. We wanted the two sides to bring their argument to the judge, and the argument and the judge decide which argument was correct. And so we removed the judge from that. Now, should we have done that? Well, I don't know. There's part of me that really kind of wishes that we hadn't done that.
It seems like a good idea on its face, the adversarial process, but then again, we have 2 million Americans locked in cages right now, so it doesn't seem to have worked out very well.
Yeah, we do. We've never really been satisfied with our system of government, and I think a lot of, you know, when we decided that we wanted this constitution, we gave the federal government a whole lot of power, and maybe the Constitution itself was a little too much power.
All right, everybody, we're talking with Paul Johnson from WOAR Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, talking about how that state is trying to take away this guy's right to bear arms. We'll be right back. Friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Paul Johnson from WOAR, Wilmington Open Air Radio, 1610 AM in Wilmington, North Carolina. And we're talking about how the state of North Carolina is trying to take away his right to bear arms because he committed a nonviolent felony back in 1983. They're now retroactively trying to take away his Second Amendment right. And, you know, Paul, you made an analogy. You said, you know, even very pro-gun control left-wingers are sympathizing with your case because they're realizing this isn't so much about guns as whether the government can retroactively take your rights away. And what if they could do this for your voting rights? What if they could do this for any of your other rights? And interesting to me, which I don't know if most people even make this distinction, but the right to bear arms is a natural right.
Mm-hmm.
Without a government, you still have the right to kill anybody who's trying to kill you first. And it's as simple as that. Now, the right to vote itself is simply a civil construct. It's not really a right so much at all as a, I don't know what legal category you put it in, a privilege
right,
or whatever, but it's a civil right.
It's a state-created juristic benefit.
Right. So for them to be able to take away your right to vote or your right to bear arms retroactively is bad enough, but for them to be able to take away a natural right that exists in a state of nature before the state even exists,
mm-hmm.
I believe is taking it an extra step even further than taking away your right to vote.
Yeah, and that's really central to what's going on here, because it's certainly the state could, like, keep you from having some sort of license, because that's a state-created right, for lack of a better word. As I said, a state-created juristic benefit, okay? So the right to vote is created by the state. A license to do something is created by the state. And in a lot of other states, North Carolina is kind of unusual in that my right was restored. The court called it a right. U.S. versus Essex said ex-felons regain the right to possess a gun by the mere passage of time. State versus Tanner said a person such as myself stands in the same shoes as any other person who had not committed a felony. That's the difference. In a lot of states, they have allowed people that were convicted of felonies to possess certain arms. But essentially, what they have done is you gave up this right when you committed this crime, and then the state has graciously allowed you to own a weapon after that. In North Carolina, it was quite different. In North Carolina, it was a right that was restored, not a state-created right. So, yeah, things like voting, things like a medical license to be an attorney, any of these things where you need a license or some sort of state-created benefit, would be a very different scenario. And these people that I'm talking about, that, you know, a lot of the Green Party type people, understand that if how much easier it would be to get rid of some of the goodies that they want from the state retroactively because you had done something in the past. If I lose, they lose.
Right. Well, good luck to you, Paul. Everybody, Paul Johnson, He runs War Radio, W-O-A-R, Wilmington, open air radio, 1610 a.m. in Wilmington, North Carolina. I really appreciate your time today, Paul.
Thank you so much, Scott.
And good luck to you in your case.
All righty.
All right, everybody, stay tuned. We'll be right back with a special announcement about RBN's new host and an hour of me ranting and raving. It's the Weekend Interview Show.